All right, here's the deal. Your name is Donald R. DeChico. Got that?
Donald R. DeChico.
Yeah, that's you. DeCicco. You were born August 11th, 1951, in Brockton, Massachusetts.
Brockton, Massachusetts.
Oh, it's a lovely town there. And your name is what?
Donald R. DeChico?
That's right, you are. It's nice to see you. Your wife's name is Mary Margaret Rowney, born June 26, 1955, in Narragansett, Rhode Island. But you're from where?
Brockton, Massachusetts.
Hey, my mother's from there. You two were married June 4th, 1975, in Koros, Greece, where you met on a fellowship following your graduation from Hobart College.
Hobart?
Hobart College.
College.
Let's put them together.
Hobart College.
The man's a wizard. Everything else you need is in here. Birth certificates, family names, school records, employers' addresses, grandmother's maiden name. Not that they'll ask, but it's in there. Most importantly, social security numbers. What's your name?
Donald R. DeChico.
Donnie DeChico. Nice to meet you. Welcome to the United States. Hello and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm your curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator, as we embark on this wild, wacky journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Mr. Sejun Zerowick. Sejun?
Thank you, Devin. And today we are going to be watching a film about the American experience, about the one of the most American of experiences, the act of immigration.
I couldn't agree with you more. Clearly, based upon my accent, I am not a naturalized citizen of the United States of America. So this film really spoke to me, Sejun. And I have to say, dare I say, this may be the most powerful and the most important episode of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe that we ever record.
Because this has... no Adam Sandler in it.
Oh, that's right. This is another Grain of Sandler episode.
Yeah.
Like grains of Sandler through the hourglass. These are the days of our lives. But that's the thing. My father was actually the one who's like, that's it? That's all he's in this movie? And you're doing an episode on it? And I looked at him.
He was right to ask you, because I have no reason for us to be doing this movie.
You know what? Jay and Silent Bob only appear in a single scene in Chasing Amy, and that film is part of the Viewers universe. Now,
for
granted,
other
there's
reasons,
a bunch of other
that's
reasons.
Not, yeah, that's
but,
not the only,
but
I thought you were going to see at least Scream 3. Jesus, like that's we get more of them in Scream 3 than I think we get of Sandler in this movie. Oh man.
But it's important. One of the other reasons, first of all, I've never seen this movie. This is a movie that I had never seen. I just knew that Adam Sandler was in it. And this season, season 5 of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we are focusing on the reboots, the remakes, and the redos. And weirdly, that's Coneheads is all three of those. And it features Adam Sandler. And it's also, I mean, I made a pretty bold claim at the end of last episode that this is the only Saturday Night Live film that Adam Sandler shows up and appears in. And that's been proven correct based upon my research. So I feel pretty good swinging for the fences with that. But I think that if as we peel back the layers of the onion that is Coneheads, we're going to see that being a part of this film was very important in terms of how Adam Sandler wanted to approach not only comedy, but working with an ensemble of people that he's familiar with.
I would even push it so far as to say working with a creative like Dan Aykroyd at a time when Dan Aykroyd can kind of do no wrong. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I know exactly
I'm trying to think of the nicest way to put this because, look, at the end of the day, we've talked a lot about the ways in which Sandler kind of just does what he wants to do, right? Like a huge part of the whole shtick with seeing a Sandler movie is you don't know if it's going to be a quote unquote traditionally good film, right? Like, but at the end of the day, like you do have kind of a knowledge of what you're getting into, right? And this is that kind of movie exactly for Dan Aykroyd. We'll talk a little bit more about exactly where in like the Aykroyd verse this movie lands, because I think that it really does kind of really show what kind of what Sandler was as an SNL like actor at the time expecting of his film career when he went and made film, which leads to a lot of his early movies being easily classifiable in the same genre of absurdist comedy as this, right? That's the way that I will put all of that. But yeah, man, this is a movie that I feel like influenced so much of my taste, and yet I have no real history with. You know, you said this is the first time you saw it, right?
I mean, I have seen the scene that I have seen literally thousands of times, mm-hmm. Because it was on in the black box era of the Decker household, was when Beldar nargles the Gorthok. I have yeah. seen him in the red predator style vision, maybe spoilers for coming later, like walking around like kind of like a video game character. It's like very reminiscent of the lemmings and how they move around in the world.
Nice.
It, like
yeah.
in like a red filter, and then him turning his weapon into a golf club. And spoilers for Coneheads. This is like literally Man. The end of the film.
I love that this is what you remember, because I forgot the last like 20 minutes of this movie. I forgot that they go to another planet in this movie. Yeah. But go ahead.
Yeah, and he ends up and using what he learned on Earth in terms of being a golfer, he's able to be successful in a situation where the plan is you die for the pleasure of your emperor. Like, it is very bread and circusy, and it's during the Meepzor like festival where the three moons align in their triple eclipse, so like it's a big deal. And that,
you know,
is
what I can't find on this movie that I need, like, you must know. What is the rating on this movie?
PG.
I can't find it anywhere on the
this
it
is
PG.
The only okay. Saturday Night Live film to attain a PG rating.
Having just watched it, I totally believe that. In the grand scheme of things, I don't know if I would have believed you if you told me before I saw it, but having just watched it, I totally understand.
Oh, and there are definitely cut scenes, and we'll talk about this later on down the line. There are cut scenes that totally would have put it into a PG-13 like motif. They yeah. had a plan with this film, and that's what we're here to explore today. As we look at it as an Adam Sandler reboot, remake, redo, that is sadly only grains of Sandler. But until we do that, before we get into that proper, little bit of housekeeping. In the time since we recorded our last episode, Anger Management, Adam Sandler, the reason why we're here, he has been awarded the Mark Twain Comedy Award. And all I can say to that is boom, satire. That's literally all I've thought since I heard that he was going to get it. And all of those videos are up on YouTube from the like ceremony when he was given that award.
Yeah.
And it was a blast. Like, I watched yes. that with my entire family.
They always are. For anybody that's interested, Jon Stewart got it a couple of years back, and the stuff from that group, if you can imagine, is just phenomenal, right? So like, go back and watch a bunch of them. But Sandler getting it this year was awesome. And yeah, I haven't watched all of it, but I watched Buscemi. That drunken bastard.
How did he get Buscemi there?
I wonder. in all of the, you know, there is always, for anybody that has not seen these before, just as a heads up, there's always some melancholy moments because they do reflect on everything that has gone on in these people's lives. So, you know, just be aware that there's going to be some stuff in that regard. I hesitate to call it like a full on trigger warning, but like, if you're going in expecting Adam Sandler, like, I feel like if anything on this show we've established, you really need to couch that.
There's a little bit of Spanglish and Rain Over Me in the proceedings. Is, I think, the way that I'm going to put it.
Nice.
Which is holy.
I would call it more Punch Drunk Love, but we haven't done that movie
yet. I've never seen Punch
yet.
Drunk Love.
Yeah, so maybe people don't get that reference.
But yes, so that's the thing. Also, and this more touches on the Say Report, the other podcast we do, the podcast that's about everything. But Brendan Fraser, who's going to be very important in an upcoming episode of this series, won a Best Actor Oscar.
Yeah.
And like, and that, there's a lot of thoughts, but, and we're going to share those. Like, definitely come over to the Say Report if you're interested in hearing about those.
Can I do a little behind the scenes? Like, just like a, this is probably a little bit of a reveal that Devin is probably going to be mad that I just let everybody in on, but I need everybody to know this so that they stop coming to us with this. we know that we haven't really mentioned it yet on the show. There's reasons. like I don't know anybody that is as aware of our Brendan Fraser respect and love that doesn't somehow understand why we have not yet really like spent an entire episode talking about it. But it's because we have a month of it coming up, guys. It's okay, we'll get there.
And my favorite thing is that in an episode we even said we know that we're not talking about it, but we promise we will.
we're covering
all our bases. If you only come to us through Adam Sandler's Cinematic Universe, trust me, we're aware of what Brendan Fraser did. This might be the first time we've, like, out loud acknowledged it.
I kind of had to, because I'm not kidding. Everybody out there is just like, what did you guys talk about? And I'm like, we haven't done it yet.
That just tells me they're not listening. So let's move past that. But it's an important thing, and it will definitely become more important when we reveal an episode that's going to be upcoming in the coming months, which is exciting. I'm excited to think about that stuff. But that's important things that have happened. And also, now's a great time to tell you why we're doing the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. And that's because Hubie Halloween came along and the idea was floated. Is there a shared Adam Sandler cinematic universe? To which Sijin and I both said, well, yeah, since like kind of forever. And people, much like they come to us with things like, oh, what'd you guys say about Brendan Fraser? The response just being like, yeah, of course there's an Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
I don't think either of us called it as early as Little Nicky, though. I think in the early days of the show, we definitely talked about how this had always kind of been a thing, and we were kind of setting out to kind of, you know, explore exactly that. And even then, I think we talked a little bit about like, oh yeah, this guy shows up here, or this person shows up there. I don't think, at least to my recollection, I don't think either of us thought it went as far back as simply just like, oh, like 20 years ago.
I would have never gone as far back as like Billy Madison, but I knew for a fact it was Little Nicky because I remember the review in the Providence Journal where the guy said, this is the greatest hits of Adam Sandler's other movies. If you weren't impressed with those, there's nothing here for you. It was the most. And like you've seen, I have seen, I don't know, I can't speak for Steve and I can't speak for you, the listener, but I have seen some just flat out mean reviews of cinema and Adam Sandler films in particular. But the one for Little Nicky was the first time where I was like, oh, like I feel like this hurt me as somebody who's excited to see this movie. Like I feel attacked by this critic.
I feel like a fan. Oh no.
No, it was deeper than that. Like it was like, oh, like, why would he say that? Like, it's mean to Adam Sandler, but it's also mean to me.
You can't say that, because this is the kind of shit that leads to Mr. Sandler and all of his infinite wisdom putting out a restraining order against this show.
Right, well, that's not even what I'm...
It was more than that, Adam.
No, that's not... it came out a little Spanish, I'm sorry. Not my intention. It was just one of those things I read in, 2000, so I was about 13 years old. No, that's not true. How freaking old is
Strap
that?
Strap in, everybody, because we are not going to talk about Coneheads that much this episode.
Oh, I'm going to talk about nothing but Coneheads. I did the research. I was 14 years old, and reading that was just like, oh, wow, this is... I did never understood this side of the world existed, is really how I approached it. But that's neither here nor there. Let's move forward into it. But yeah, much like people came to us about the Brendan Fraser thing, a lot of people, when we said, of course there's a shared cinematic universe, were like, well, prove it. Put your money where your mouth is. So that's what we're trying to do with this. We're trying to build our cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
This episode is like we said we were going to build a house and we happened to drive through a neighborhood and then we saw this movie. one is so tangentially related to the other that I don't know. I honestly watched this entire movie today. I was rewatching it today so that we could record about it, because we will talk about how I have, as much as I don't have any like attachment to this movie, I have a lot of weird memories of it, but yeah, I watched this movie this entire time wondering if this was just an April Fool's joke you were playing on me the entire time. I was wondering if I was going to sit down with you and you were going to be like, joke's on you, we're doing Eight Crazy Nights again. Okay fine.
I'd be good for Passover, but no, I approach every episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe with like a real professional edge. Like, I am willing to get my hands dirty and find out the information. I am not kidding when I tell everybody and anybody who is listening right now, I put the fucking work in with Coneheads. I watched all 11 sketches. That's nice. There's more than 11. There's 11 movies. I think there's 15 sketches overall. I watched all 15.
11 movies?
No, Saturday Night Live movies. There are 11 Saturday Night Live movies. I believe there are 15 sketches. Here's the thing, and we'll talk about the thing afterwards because
I really liked Coneheads 8 when they fought Thanos, but that was, you know,
I liked Coneheads 9, the crossover with the Gremlins, where Beldar just ate all the Gremlins.
We just ate the Gremlins.
Like, that's there was no threat because Beldar was there with his Ghostbusterian jawline.
These are a delicacy on Remulac.
They are delicious. Please begin the mass consumption ritual. Yeah, so not only did I watch that, but came to find out that in 1983, Rankin Bass, yes, that Rankin Bass of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
My drunk Santa? No one likes a skinny Santa. That one? Rankin Bass?
That Rankin Bass were responsible for producing a pilot for an animated series. And this might be a surprise to anybody who's never watched that bit of. I'm happy it's not lost media.
Silver and gold. Silver and gold.
What is silver and gold?
I don't know, but they taste amazing.
They are precious metals to the people of this planet, Beldar. And we get to do the Conehead voice, like, the whole episode. And nobody can get mad at us. You can get mad at us. You have every right to get mad at us. But it is. I watched that, and then I watched the film. And come to find out that the film, very much a retelling not only of those sketches, but also, weirdly, that animated series in a lot of really crazy ways.
So, I don't know when we want to dive into what here, but, I mean, so the SNL movies have a really bad reputation for one reason or another, where people feel like, oh, this is just a bunch of sketches all just slapped together. And, like, in some cases that works really well, a la, like, a Wayne's World, where people just fucking can't get enough of that shit, beat to beat to beat. And then you have your Coneheads, where people are like, I don't think this is a movie. And it's like, you're not entirely wrong. Kentucky Fried Movie's a movie, right? So, yeah, it's fine.
I would argue Coneheads is more of a movie than Kentucky Fried Movie.
Yes. I don't think you'd be alone in that argument, considering but, like,
all right, thing that I was leading up to, and then I will let you get the facts and figures, is I fucking loved this movie. And I don't know, and here's the really incredible thing for me. I don't know if I loved this movie because I put in all of the work to see everything that came before so that I understood literally every single reference that Dan Aykroyd and Tom Davis. I kind of did. I had a singular pursuit with this movie. And
I can hear you chewing on toilet paper now.
He actually just kind of sucks it down. But yeah, he chews on soap. It is the grid-like breakfast discs that I am enjoying more. Pop-Tarts stay Pop-Tarts, which is really just a hilarious thing about it. I loved this movie. I love this movie so much that I even watched the State Farm ads, which are 2015, so have no bearing on anything we're talking about today. But I did. I've consumed everything except for the Conehead tie-in comic books. But guess what my plan is for this weekend, guys?
So I have to ask this at some point, right?
Yeah, please.
Jane Curtin is Third Rock from the Sun's Jane Curtin, right?
Not only is Jane Curtin Third Rock from the Sun Mary Albright, but
Dr.
Mary Albright, that's very true. The other writing team, because it's Dan Aykroyd and Tom Davis who are responsible for creating the characters and all of that, but the other writing team of Bonnie Turner and Terry Turner, they're the creators behind Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, that's an interesting pull. So here's the question. They must, I don't remember it. I don't have a deep knowledge of Third Rock from the Sun, although I kind of really want to become that guy. Can I become the Third Rock guy? I'm going to become the Third Rock guy. That's for off mic.
You do know that I don't ask for permission. I just do this thing.
That's the difference between you and me. But they must have at some point made a Coneheads joke or reference, right? You don't have her on that show for, what did it run? For like 5 years, 6 years?
9, I think. I think we were watching... When it switched over to like a single camera from a multi camera, yeah. They go to New York and it's this crazy. They want like because
oh man, Third Rock from the Sun upperclassmen. Like what do they do?
Well, no, Tommy wants to try to like get on SNL. It's a specific 2-episode like arc where they go to New York.
Oh yeah. It's the road trip 2-parter, right? Seinfeld has one of these too when they go and sell the show in LA, right?
Yeah. Well, they don't sell the show. Kramer goes out to L.A. because Jerry is tired of him mooching off of him. And it's okay that we're talking about Seinfeld because Jason Alexander and Michael Richards are in this movie, guys. So it's tangentially related, which is kind of the major theme of the Coneheads episode of Adam Sandler's Cinematic Universe. But it is that
tangents and tangents and tangents. Yeah.
So those two writers go on to do it. You have to imagine that's why Jane Curtin is Dr. Mary Albright, but I
hope that people are understanding how fucking earnest. I mean, we're always extremely earnest, and I think sometimes people think we're being ironic. And I like it's not that we are not. We are Gen X and millennial. Like we know how irony works, and we can definitely ironize with the best of them. But this is not irony. Like this is legitimately Third Rock from the Sun was a great show, and she is phenomenal. Jane Curtin is phenomenal as far as I'm concerned, second lead of that show. Right, like John Lithgow and then her are the reason to like watch that show for me. And then like you also get like a young Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and you also get Fred Stewart, and oh, I'm gonna fucking kick myself for not remembering the last
Kristen
one.
Kristen Stewart.
French Stewart is definitely French Stewart.
French
though,
Stewart,
right?
And then she's also, she might not be Kristen Stewart. No, Kristen Stewart
Johnson.
Is, Kristen Johnson. I'm sorry. Kristen Stewart's the vampire fucker. She's done other things. She was really good in
so many things.
Charlie's Angels.
To do with this
Underwater
really
was
role.
Really, really good. Yes. Adventureland. American Ultra. I love Kristen Stewart. Yeah. And I always confuse. This is a Devin Decker blind spot. Kristen Johnson and Kristen Stewart is something that I am confusing all the time. So big apologies.
You want to talk about your SNL connections? Is Wayne Knight also ends up having a huge role in that because isn't he Sally's like.
Paramore.
They end up getting married by the end of the show, I think.
That's correct.
But Jane Curtin is phenomenal in that show, is what I'm really getting at. And so, like, getting to go back and watch her play this role again and remembering that she was on, like, the 70s SNL is amazing. So, yeah, so I want to do some facts and figures stuff, but how does the show normally run? Remind me.
Seijin, you ignorant slut, it is time for facts and figures.
So Coneheads the Movie is a 1993 film, right? But I do think we need to talk a little bit about, especially because you did all the research, Dev, it would go to waste if we did not talk about, that this is a sketch from like 1977, right? Isn't that the date on the original sketch?
Yeah, the first sketch premiered in the second season of Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. The Ralph Nader hosted episode.
Ralph fucking Nader. Seatbelt man himself.
Season 2, episode 11. It is the Coneheads at home, and they are completely introduced as this couple from outer space, portrayed by Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin, and mm-hmm. they also have a daughter who is played by Lorraine Newman.
Nice.
And that is, so it's this excellent thing. And also in that very first sketch, they...
Don't drop that knowledge and walk away from it, because we're not going to come back to that. Lorraine Newman, for anybody that doesn't know, shows up in this movie. Not as the daughter, because she's much older at this point. Yeah. She ends up playing the woman in the neighborhood, the Hoa, that like gets them involved with all the stuff at the school.
No,
PTA,
that
sorry.
Is not true at all. That's Julia
Lorraine...
Sweeney.
Oh, that's
who's
Julia
the
Sweeney.
Principal.
So where is Lorraine Newman? Because she is in this movie.
Lorraine
right?
Newman is not seen until they're back on the planet of Remulac. So they go back to the planet Remulac. That's going to happen. I should probably get to the synopsis before I cannibalize the whole thing, but let's keep going. She
is another Conehead.
Yeah,
she is in
another,
the movie
Conehead,
as another Conehead. Yeah.
And she is, I'm pretty sure, everyone says that she acts as an aunt to Connie. That's like what the accepted like are story they the for ones her character
that,
is.
Are they the ones at the? Are they the ones at the event at the end of the film talking about what good seats?
Yeah,
they
she's
have?
Like usually yeah, we are up in the God, top. This so is good. The closest we have
As,
ever been.
Like this is way behind the scenes shit. This is like definite sausages made. This is material, but like. As somebody that is currently working in the box office for an arena, right? And like the ways in which people are like, hey, so like we normally have these reserved seats, but we notice you're done selling reserves. You got any open ones left that we can move forward? And that woman in that movie today, as I rewatched it, I was like, I've been talking to you all fucking week. I've been talking to you. This like, we got the best seats for this death for this death event. And I'm just like, God, what is wrong with you?
It is also the Meepzor Festival, which is the shining festival of the Remulakian culture. They will harvest all of the gelatin pools and bathe in them.
So 1977, right, is when this sketch premieres, and it is.
Well,
it's 15 years later. Sorry, go ahead.
It's weirdly 16 years later that it becomes a thing. When you consider Connie's age, it's very interesting that they would have landed on Earth in this movie in 1977 in order for Connie to be 16 in 1993. Though it might be 1992 based upon the Cosmopolitan that we see pre-Matt reading a little bit later into the film.
I mean, we know how movies work, Devin. Yes, Dan Aykroyd wrote it 2 years earlier and took him a while to make the movie. That's the,
right. But I don't know. I don't know if they set it. Like, that's one of those things is, I don't know if he was setting it for 93 or for 92. Like, that's one of those weird things that also Dan Aykroyd specifically does with his scripts.
Like, well, he makes them very vague, right?
Yeah.
So one of the big things to know about this movie is because of the success of the characters, because they appeared for the next like decade on SNL sketches, right?
No, they did not.
I thought they had like 7 or 8 sketches.
They have 15 sketches.
15?
All of them happen between season 2 and season 4 of the series.
Holy shit.
That's
they
burn bright and then fade away.
Okay, so as somebody that does not like invest in SNL anymore, there was a period, because I think everybody eventually goes through that, right, where they're like super into whatever's going on. And for me, it was when I was in junior high. Specifically, the episode that you can point to kind of get like a good beat on where I was at is the episode where The Rock hosts and he does the whole Clark Kent sketch where everybody knows he's Superman, right? So, like, that's pretty much where I was watching. Or Britney Spears has a phenomenal monologue about how everybody sexualizes her. And then, like, she apparently she has, like, fake breasts on that, like, start, like, moving on their own in the middle of, like, the monologue. It's a phenomenal moment for her. So that's the era that I was watching, right? But I haven't really invested much since. A little bit in the whole 2016, 2018 era, getting to watch a lot of the Trump stuff and more specifically the Hillary Clinton stuff. But like, that's kind of the deepest I ever got into that series, right? Into SNL, that series. Like, let's talk about it like it's not one of the most influential things ever in my life, despite the fact that I wasn't watching it, which is kind of my point, right? Is like, no matter how much I wasn't really watching SNL, SNL kind of made everything that was going on around me. Right. We've talked about this on Say Report before. We've talked about it here before. But like the impact of SNL, whether you were watching SNL or not, can't be denied in like what you were consuming. Right. And so the Coneheads kind of lands in this really interesting place for me where like I imagine it's this huge cultural phenomenon because, you know, my dad and his friends and stuff would watch SNL. And you know what would come on Saturday nights after SNL? Would be a rerun of old SNL. So I have these really weird kind of moments in my head where like I feel like Eddie Murphy, for instance, I feel like Eddie Murphy was on that show for 10 years, but I think he was only on for like 3, right?
Yeah, he wasn't very, maybe even 2. Like it was,
and he wasn't on when I was watching it live.
No.
Right?
No.
Right? But in my head, I remember watching those late night episodes of that because we'd be out and we'd be watching, or we'd be out and we'd be seeing shit. And like, but then you get super fucked up because then I think of somebody like Keenan, who I remember being like kind of new and being like, oh my God, Keenan's doing sketch again. Like, we got to watch the new season of SNL because Keenan's back. And now that motherfucker's been there for 13 years or something like that, right?
I think it's
like,
almost 20 years that he's been with it.
Jesus! So my understanding of how like of SNL seasons and like where they're at is borked as it is, add to that my own personal issues with like time, like marketing, and like so, like it's completely all over the
and
place.
Comedy Central for us in the 90s, like if you were watching, like all they did was show
and then
SNL.
and they
So
didn't show and they didn't necessarily show episodes of SNL. Yes, they showed episodes of SNL, but they would also show best ofs and stuff. So you would watch a bunch of stuff that was like the best of Bill Murray, the best of Dan Aykroyd, the best of Eddie Murphy, and you just watch a bunch of shit in a row, and it all kind of blends together eventually, right? Like you got inundated with that shit. And then in those early days of the internet, when I was watching SNL proper, one of the coolest things was that NBC had an SNL dedicated page where you didn't just pick episodes. You could literally pick sketches. You could look up like all of their main players and find just like, I just want to watch all of the random Chris Rock sketches today, right? Like, and then you'd got like a whole series of them. Adam Sandler was a huge get for us because you'd also get a bunch of music wrapped up in that.
And then the big thing, I want to say it was for the 25th anniversary of SNL, which they're almost at celebrating their 40th year of SNL. That's going to be happening in 2025, assuming the show keeps running, right? But where else are you going to go? To quote Billy Eichner in Difficult People, you're a five-year-old running away. Where else are you going to go?
I mean, it's kind of like predicting the end of The Simpsons. Yeah. It's a fool's gamble at this point to guess it's ever going to end. Like,
yeah, there was a time there with SNL, but we're not doing the SNL podcast. We're talking specifically about Conan's. But yeah, like it was this thing where...
But we kind of have to talk about SNL, right?
Oh, we because have to. The we atmosphere... certainly have to.
So the atmosphere that Aykroyd in that second year of SNL is in, where this is the kind of shit he creates, and the fact that it is something that they come back to in 1993 to this like this family-oriented comedy movie that they decide to put out under the like SNL Lorne Michaels banner, right? Like this is... For some reason, they come back to this, and for some reason, they put it out there, right? And what? Why is that? And then why does Adam Sandler, working on this movie, make the decisions he makes later? It makes total sense when you look at the whole, like, SNL to silver screen pipeline that is only just kind of still being constructed by the time that Sandler really starts kicking into gear with Billy Madison and then eventually Happy Gilmore and stuff, right? But, like...
I mean, you say that, but... The films that will have released, this is the third Saturday Night Live movie.
That's what I mean, is it's only the third movie. So, like, you can't call it a completed project yet.
No.
They're still figuring shit out.
They are figuring shit out. But by the time Billy Madison hits in 1995, after Coneheads, you have Wayne's World 2, which was fast-tracked into theaters because of how successful the first movie was. Mm-hmm. After that, you have It's Pat that comes out in 1994, followed by Stewart Saves His Family in 1995.
Al Franken, Stewart Saves His Family. Darn it, people like you. Yep. Not your movie, but you.
They like you, and isn't that something? But so those are the six SNL movies are out and ready to be consumed by the time Billy Madison is out in theaters. Possibly Billy Madison came out before Stewart Saves His Family, but Stewart Saves His Family was definitely made around the same time as Billy Madison. And if you hear the horror stories from current cast members who happen to be in Coneheads, like a Chris Farley or a David Spade, who had to be in L.A. shooting this film and then fly back to New York to be live on Saturday night.
Wonder why Farley did as much coke as he did, right?
Yeah. Like, you wonder why Adam Sandler would want to get out of there and focus on the movie making. Like, this movie is such a weird thing just in terms of everything around it.
Well, and I think that the other big thing that, you know, this is entirely speculation at this point, so take this with a grain of salt, but I think it's really interesting that you don't really ever see, as much as you see Sandler do character work in his comedies, he doesn't ever do one of his famous characters in a movie, not even from his CDs and stuff. We've talked a lot about how he borrows from those, is influenced by those characters and the work he does on those characters in the movies he does, but he doesn't just ever do a one-to-one. And so he's never truly beholden to like an audience concept of what a character should be, because he doesn't end up on screen as Opera Man, right? Like, that's just not what you see from him.
As much as Canteen Boy is the water boy in like influences and what the character is doing, is not the same character.
He very distinctly creates a different character that he's allowed to break the rules with, right? Yep. Because you look at something like Coneheads, and this gets to some of the questions I had about the rating and the comedy that you see in this, is like, it's a very specific bit that they then get kind of stuck on for an entire movie. And like, you know, that is what it is. Either the bit works and it works for 90 minutes, or the bit doesn't work and you don't put up with it for more than a minute. And I will say the movie is not extremely successful after the success of, you pointed it out earlier, Wayne's World. Like, Wayne's World went on to be, in it just a year previously, was a $20 million movie that made $185 million. Like, that is a huge success, which is why I think you then see the bump in, like, we're going to just produce every SNL movie that we can. And that's when you end up with something like fucking Coneheads. And Coneheads makes $21 million, period. There's not even like a budget on what it cost, because I'm sure it was more than that, especially when you consider, well, and look at the, like, remove the actors, remove all of the, like, the making of a movie away from it. Like, one of the biggest things in this movie that I could not wrap my head around, like, as I was watching it today, is how much prosthetic and CGI, like, really early CGI work is in this film.
I will be forever haunted by Connie eating that Subway sandwich. Forever haunted.
The moment when he opens his mouth wide in the dentist's office, where it goes from Dan Aykroyd in prosthetics already to a CGI moment of his mouth opening to then the prosthetic of the wide mouth. And it looks really smooth in the movie. This is not me saying like, oh my God, it looks so ugly in the movie. It haunts me forever. It is so well done. It will haunt me forever. It is ridiculous how much pristine special effect work is put into the Coneheads movie, to the point where it's literally upsetting to watch some of the shit that happens, because it is actually making it too real for me.
Well, I mean, you have to think, there's what people want from Aykroyd in 92 is Ghostbusters 3. They right. also want it from Murray and from Ramis.
Right.
That is what everybody is clamoring for. So Harold Ramis and Bill Murray, and we've talked about this on the Sarah Report, and we're probably going to talk about it on this coming episode, because this movie awakened a lot in the Say Report sections of my mind.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that I am excited to talk about.
We're going to probably talk about it in show proper, but this weekend, but yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel right talking about the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Ramis and Murray go do this, like, still science fiction bent sort of story, but, like, very grounded in the human experience and, like, existential dread with something right. like Groundhog Day.
Right.
While Dan Aykroyd, his pivot is, well, I'm going to go back to SNL, which has, like, treated me as well as it has over all these years.
But you have to think about one of the other movies that Aykroyd's coming off of. And this is something that I joked about before, but I promised you I would reveal all when the episode was recording. So here we are. Aykroyd is at a moment in his career, and I think that you can really put him in a really interesting bubble at this point to really look at what he ends up doing. Like, his early stuff, like Blues Brothers and stuff like that, is, as far as I'm concerned, just like groundbreaking, phenomenal comedy cinema. The ways in which you get in Blues Brothers, you get a lot of really interesting stuff as far as like silent movie era comedy, like brought forward into like, hey, now we do got color and sound and all that shit. Like, there's some really interesting stuff in terms of that, right? And I don't think Aykroyd really finds his footing in the 90s. And the three movies that I point to are Ghostbusters 2, Coneheads, and Nothing But Trouble, which is what he does in 91. And that's the movie I was joking about, where like he thinks it's funny to put John Candy in a dual role, one of which is in a dress, right? Like there's like really weird bits in that movie. His penis nose, which like, that's like, people talk about Nothing But Trouble and they joke about like, oh, the judge has a penis for a nose. But like, no, that's the joke of the movie, guys. Like, that's not people pointing out, oh, that's a bad prosthetic. It is, but it's purposely so. Yeah. The joke of the prosthetic, if you look at it in the movie, is it is shaped like a penis on his face. That is the level of humor of that movie, right?
I will admit, like, to you right here, when I guessed Transylvania 6-5000, I was thinking of Nothing But
You were
trouble.
Thinking of Nothing
It
but
was
trouble,
the cover, yeah. I was thinking of it. I'm like, but what's the title of that movie? Transylvania 65,000.
Transylvania 65,000 is the Jeff Goldblum classic that I also adore, but yeah.
I know you like, these are two of Cijan's favorite movies. If you're going to be doing the stuff you do with them, you have to be aware of them, but they have, unfortunately, as somebody who's never seen Nothing But Trouble, opening that door for me having to do an episode on it. Excited, though. I'll be honest there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's...
Well, so this, I don't know, so let me see if I can do my best to kind of encapsulate this then as somebody that has not seen that, because I if you look at the ways in which Coneheads, the absurdist cartoonish comedy that you see in Coneheads, and I mean like those moments when they speed up the camera, right, where he like walks around really silly, or that moment like when his mouth opens super wide and you see it. It's not just like a turn away from camera and it comes back and it's a different face on him. You literally get to see his face stretch in unnatural ways.
It looks
ways.
Like when he's getting takes it over by Viggo in Ghostbusters 2. It is the same sort of effect.
It's almost like he's like watching what Tim Burton's doing, right? And being like, oh man, that's really fun stuff to play with. Like that there's this creepy, dark, absurdist humor to what Aykroyd's doing. And that is somewhat on display in Coneheads, but at a very safe level, right? Nothing But Trouble is that to the fucking extreme. Like, they straight up use, like, Warner Brothers Looney Tunes sound effects in a moment when, like, two people, like, die in the bone shredder in that movie, where you're just like, this is gonna haunt me for the rest of my life, right? And Coneheads never quite gets there, but if you look at Ghostbusters 2, right, it feels even more like that kind of just, like, neuter but dark concepts, right? Like, so Aykroyd is in this really weird movie-making phase where he's very into this really dark, fringy shit, right? Which we kind of know in his, like, you know, in his actual life, he's very into this sort of stuff, ghosts and aliens and things like that. And then, like, you know, he really wants to celebrate that stuff, though. He's not looking at it as inspiration for, like, creepy, like horror movie-esque films. Like, he wants to still make family movies, right? And I would point to Ghostbusters 2 and Coneheads as that, and even Nothing But Trouble is so absurd and so silly that I have to imagine that he thought it was just like a grand time that like movie studios looked at and were like, are you out of your fucking mind? Like that. And so like he's trying so hard to kind of build this like absurdist fun comedy genre that has this like dark edge to it with these movies, and none of them really land, because the most successful out of the three that I mentioned would have to be Ghostbusters 2, and even that one is kind of the bastard child of Ghostbusters movies until you talk about 2016, but that's a different conversation for the reasons it's disliked. But like Ghostbusters 2 for a long time has that weird like kind of black mark on it, because it's just too family friendly and too silly and too goofy compared to the first one.
It's neutered compared to the first film,
and Coneheads is like weirdly neutered in terms of like SNL movies to this point, when you have Blues Brothers and then Wayne's World and then Coneheads.
Yeah, you have the R-rated Blues Brothers. I think Wayne's World has to be PG-13, right? I can't imagine that has an R rating. And maybe I'm wrong on that one, but then
PG-13, MPAA rating, PG-13. No, I mean, like, you know, there's that entire scene where he dances around in his underwear, so it's at least PG-13, right? Yeah,
which I didn't know if it might go a step further, and then they pull a Ghostbusters 2 with Wayne's World 2, but then there's a bunch of naked butt in that movie. Like, there's a whole character who's just about the nudity. Well, we're here to talk about Coneheads, though, and God, it is, though. Everything you're saying is correct. And one of the other things that we've looked at, we've been pretty squarely focused on 1993 cinema over at the Save Report.
Yeah.
But another movie that we looked at very recently was Super Mario Brothers. And we kind of collectively agreed that Super Mario Brothers, the movie from 1993 with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo, mm-hmm. is sort of the last 80s movie. And there's a part of me that would say that Coneheads is kind of the first 90s movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I can definitely get on board with that, because this like weird like feeling of we're going to bring back this thing that we all it's a safe bet, right? Like people are literally already doing this bit in front of the water cooler every day. So like we know it's a guaranteed hit. We're going to give it more money than it's ever dreamed of to make like high quality like look to it.
The cones look so good. The one, like, because you got to think, it's Saturday Night Live. So Aykroyd and Curtin are being slammed into their cones from probably like Weekend Update or from some other sketch in order to come into Coneheads. And actually, right. I mean, I tried to focus mostly on the Conehead sketches and not watch around them. Though one of the episodes also features cheeseburger, 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 no Coke Pepsi, no fried chips. Like that's another, like that's in a Coneheads episode. And that's an iconic Saturday Night Live sketch.
Right.
And to think of like, that's just crazy. But usually before it, it would be something pre-recorded or during the Conehead sketch, there would be something pre-recorded. Digital short sketches before the Lonely Island
guy. Yeah, if you ever want a really interesting look at how SNL works, look at the structure of the show the next time you watch it and clock like what happens after commercial breaks, after pre-recorded bits, after music acts. Most often that's where you'll see the most work done, like as far as like the costuming and makeup and sets, it'll always roll into the most elaborate sketches after one of those big moments where they've got time to work on them.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So Coneheads is always following like pre-recorded stuff or something like that, or something that didn't feature Aykroyd and Curtin in it. But one of the things you notice when you're watching all 15 of them in order, and not like cleaned up at all, like I watched the ones that are up on Peacock, so they are still 4:3. There hasn't been any sort of like remastering on them. There are tears in the film stock and things like that. It's an interesting experience. Is if they have like a strand of hair coming out, like it's kind of all you can focus on because it is that like weird imperfection. And that happened with one with Jane Curtin. And then another one is they didn't seat the cone low enough. So she has two pairs of eyebrows. And it's just like, and you think about like that Saturday Night Live. So then as soon as I'm watching the movie and I'm looking at the cone prosthesis, I'm just like, oh my God, they look so natural.
Well, and she's got the best one of the whole movie, in specifically in the birthing scene, because she's lying there, right, giving birth, sweating her ass off, and the cone is perfectly, like, you know, make-upped for all of that. And then there's this move when she pushes where there's a prosthetic, like, some type of actuator in the prosthetic that, like, scrunches her foreheads within the cone, and it is one of the most natural things that goes along with what she's doing in that moment. It is a phenomenal like beat of physical like on-set special effect. It's awesome.
Yeah, the agreed upon number is that there were 12 specific people who were dedicated only to the prostheses and the makeup related to them.
Damn.
Like, and that there's some of the other famous Dan Aykroyd stuff, and like I don't know like how deep we should go into it, but like he was not the easiest person to work with is kind of the safest thing that I'm going to say. And the lot mistreating that makeup team, who was like vital to making the film, he went off on a rant in full Conehead makeup about like, why are you giving my guys guff about this? And then he ends up destroying a security booth and just letting any car that's driving by onto the Paramount lot. Like hit, like if you read some of the background stuff of this movie, if Adam Sandler's there, and even if Adam Sandler's just there for the one scene that he's in, right? The scene that we recreated at the beginning of this, that's literally the only scene that Adam Sandler is in. Let's not lose the fact that we are doing an Adam Sandler podcast here. You have to imagine that he's seeing it. And you also have to think that being born in 1966, he's 11 years old.
Well, we're talking about Aykroyd, right?
Yeah, like, we're talking about Aykroyd with the way that he's acting. But
right,
then Sandler,
so I mean, like, but
that
like, idea being that Sandler, even if he's not seeing it that day, he's working on SNL. Like he's coming. He knows. Like there's no way that, like, guess what? After you leave, people will continue to talk about you, especially if you're that kind of asshole. Yeah. So like, I'm sure he has heard what a nightmare it is, and like. So this movie really leans into like the cameo appearance, right? Like more so than I think I would argue Wayne's World did, you know, as somebody that watched that recently. I don't remember there being, you know, there's some of that stuff, but it's not huge. And it's not every scene like this one is. I mean, like I Drew Carey shows up for like a beat.
Ellen DeGeneres' first movie is Coneheads as the diving instructor.
Yeah.
It's
and so
Tom Arnold on the freaking golf course.
Blues Brothers kind of has that, but everybody has a really meaty part when they show up.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, it really feels like in this one, it can get a little highlight, really, where, like, just somebody like Tim Meadows shows up for, like, two lines.
Yeah, and Tim Meadows at the time is a cast member, but it's strange, especially you had shared that photo after we did the anger management episode where I'm like, where's Tim Meadows? And then come to find out they had cropped out their only, you know, actor of color from the photo that was used for the magazine article you sent me.
Yeah.
Because I had found the original where he was there and they just cropped him out. And it was like, I thought so. I like, because you sent me that photo and I became obsessed with trying to figure out what episode it was taken after. And without Tim Meadows being in that picture, I'm like, it can't be any of them unless he took the picture. But yeah, so yeah, this is a very strange movie. The fact that it is so family friendly and sanitized, the fact that it is based on 15 sketches that ran from 77 to 79. So like 16 to 14 years ago, the fact that it's Dan Aykroyd again, who was approached because A, he did Blues Brothers in 1980, but also, to quote Lorne Michaels, I feel like we only scratched the surface with the Coneheads.
Yeah. And then but I also think is in 91, he does Nothing But Trouble, and it's not, it is a bomb. It is a fucking bomb of a film.
Yeah.
Well, so think about the position he's in, not wanting to do another Ghostbusters, having just bombed on Nothing But Trouble.
Well, wanting to do another Ghostbusters, but not having his collaborators on board. He wants to do it. He wrote it. We've seen the script in the Ghostbusters video game. There's a reason that takes place in 1992.
Yeah, but, sorry, like, but like...
No, but I know what you're saying.
Not being able to get that movie off the ground.
Right, right.
Not being able to do much of anything else because of the other bomb he was in.
Yeah, it makes sense. And then to find out in the research that they had tried to make this an animated series because of the clout, and even that is 4 years after the Coneheads have appeared on SNL. That they're trying to do an animated series about it. About,
I mean, it was a meme back before memes existed, right? Yeah. Like the Conehead like voice and like jokes and bits and bobs and watching rewatching those sketches and stuff. Like they were a huge success for a thing that like you had to go looking for. So it was much harder to become that back in the day.
Yeah. And it does, and it feels like that 90s, if this is not the first, let's take something from the 70s and present it to the audience of the 90s, I would be very surprised.
And the last thing I will say on all of this, we've talked a lot about how we feel like they toned a lot of the comedy down and who they're trying to aim for, and I think that is all the more emulated by the Coneheads, one of the many posters for this movie, but like... The entire tagline for the movie is young ones, parental units, we summon you. We want the whole family to come to this one. It was essentially what they said right on the poster.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also the sanitation of the big bit in that very first sketch is the, you know, so Ronnie is introduced. The character of Ronnie, portrayed by Chris Farley here, is in that very first Conehead sketch, portrayed by Bill Murray. And it's weird is just what I'm just going to say, because he's picking up a 16-year-old to go on a date and he looks like Bill Murray. And they're like, come, let us have the mask.
To be fair, though, the character is supposed to be another teenager, right?
Yeah, like, he's supposed to be a teenager,
okay.
But he
it's not that
he don't look
Bill
like
Murray
no.
at like 30, walk on set, right. Be like, where's your kid?
Right. Okay. But it's got very 90210s, like
just as a man that has had some known issues with the ways in which he treats women on set, I want to make sure we're being very clear about the context here.
The whole
that's
point
all.
Is that he is supposed to be in high school as well.
Right, yeah.
But again, that's something that I would question about Chris Farley's portrayal of the Ronnie character as well, because he seems so much older than Connie that I question if he is a high schooler.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that I kind of just assumed that he was in school with her, but you're right that I don't think the movie ever actually lands on that. It just...
Yeah, yeah. Like he's a mechanic. He works at an auto shop, and that's how they meet. They don't meet in school or anything.
You're allowed to be a mechanic and still be in high school.
My first job was as a mechanic at a gas station.
Right. But they don't. They also don't ever enforce it either. Yeah. So I don't know what
like
the
he's never
supposed
at
to be.
The only event he's at is at the dive meet. Like he's not in
any
other
the prom. Yeah.
Well, then the prom, but you know, girls take their older college boyfriends to prom all the time. They usually buy beer for the group. I don't know. So like, so
I don't know. I wasn't popular anyway.
I was, but what are you going to do? Yeah, it's one of those situations where, so let's have the mass consumption, chips and beer. And then when they finally recreate that in this movie, it is with chips and Pepsi. And there is no bigger sanitation than the fact that he does not open a six pack of beer and just go to town on it. Like, it's just, that's a central Coneheads bit. That happens in almost everything where freaking Beldar is just going to town on a six-pack of beer.
I want to talk more about this and the what are the Coneheads? Like, what is the point here? Because it's a conversation to have. I do think we probably need to get a synopsis out.
Yeah, no, if we don't do it before the hour mark, I think we turn into pumpkins based upon the witch's curse.
Oh, Hubie's mom?
Yeah, Hubie's mom. June Squibb.
Congratulations. Yeah, I was looking more for a character name, but yeah.
Mrs. Halloween. Mrs. Dubois. All right. It's synopsis time. People of Earth, they are timekeepers from the planet Remulac. Our weapons are useless against them. I lost the rest of my synopsis. Instructions, times, dates, place, orders for the UN... I don't know where I lost it. I will ring the remaining 455 words. Beldar and Premat are extraterrestrials sent to our planet in the 70s to enslave humanity and use our labor to construct a fueling station for their Highmaster. Unfortunately, during their approach, their Star Cruiser was shot down by the U.S. Air Force and crash-landed in the Hudson River. With their resources gone, they're forced to find employment and shelter in Jersey City until the time when they're able to contact their home planet for rescue. Luckily, Beldar is able to find employment at an electronics repair shop run by a man named Otto, which allows his genetomate and himself to afford a place to live and the opportunity to gather the parts required to construct a communication device. When asked for his social security number by his employer, Beldar admits that he is an illegal alien. Undeterred by this information, Otto sets Beldar up with a falsified identity provided by the charmingly handsome Carmine Wiener. This is where Beldar's troubles really begin. In addition to being told by Remulac that it will be at least 7 Zerls before a rescue ship can come for them, and Premat revealing that she is pregnant, his usage of a dead man's SSN puts him squarely in the crosshairs of Gorman Seedling and the INS. Seedling pursues Beldar without mercy, forcing him to leave Otto's and take a job driving a taxi. It's here that Beldar and Premat's daughter Connie is born, and Beldar vows to provide a better life for her. The Conehead family is able to take their savings and move to the Laurel Hills Quadrant. What's even better is Seedling gets promoted to a new position in the Southwest region and decides that Beldar is now his replacement's problem. Over the next 16 years, the Coneheads are able to build a nice life for themselves. Beldar opens his own driving instruction school, they grow friendly with their neighbors the Farbers, and Beldar has picked up a new passion in golf. Apart from the height of their skulls, the Coneheads seem like the perfect suburban family. The good times won't last forever, though. Seedling is up for INS commissioner, but before he can be appointed, the review board wants him to close the Coneheads case. To further complicate the matter, Connie is a curious teenager with hopes and urges she wants to explore, much to the chagrin of her doting father. Just as INS has the Coneheads surrounded, a Remulacian Star Cruiser arrives to rescue and bring them home. But after expending their time and effort on Earth building their life and family, Beldar isn't sure Remulac feels like home anymore, and must now choose to comply and stay, or emigrate to Earth forever to give his daughter the world.
Yeah. Man. So it's a fish out of water story, right? That's the bit, right?
The whole bit is, this was a 12:55 SNL sketch. And if you don't know what that means, then congratulations. You don't have useless knowledge in your mind. But all of the sketches that seem to go on to the highest prominence were ones that Lorne didn't really like. Like, by his own admission, he didn't really like them. So if we have time, we'll do it at the 12:55. But if we end up running long, it won't really affect the product if it has to be cut.
Oh yeah, there are sketches from SNL that we never see because they rehearse and practice and get all this shit ready, and then something happens that night. The band goes a little long, commercials run a little over, and suddenly we're not seeing like two or three sketches that have been written every episode.
Right, and they're called the 1255s, and the most famous one is Wayne's World because Lorne Michaels hated Wayne's World. He did not think that it was funny, and then it goes on. And suddenly it's this huge phenomenon when the first Wayne's World sketch airs. Coneheads is very similar to that. They used to play a game at the SNL writer's room to determine what drugs the people were on when they came up with the sketch idea. And by Dan Aykroyd's own admission, Coneheads is a pothead sketch. It started out as a pinhead sketch, like Zippy the Pinhead.
Yeah.
And it was going to be the pinheads from France. And the whole bit of it from Dan Aykroyd is, man, there's so much empty space at the top of the TV screen. What if the heads of the people extended all the way up?
A very pot-oriented comment. What if the whole screen was just head, man?
What if it was all head, bruh?
You sound like the biggest narcs right now.
Oh no, fellow young people.
Oh man.
But yeah, so that's the whole thing. So that's where it starts. And they were like the pinheads from France, and Lorne Michaels was like, maybe we don't do a thing about deformities. Maybe like that's not SNL's bag in our second season. So then they finally
bullshit. Considering the amount of shit Lorne Michaels has been on board with putting on TV, I doubt that was what he
said.
Well,
according to the book, according to the behind the scenes at SNL, that was his statement on it. But then they had the sudden idea. I believe Dan Aykroyd was watching The Day the Earth Stood Still and seeing their large foreheads. He's like, "Oh man, we make the pinheads from France. They're aliens."
Would very much argue it's more this island Earth.
It is this island Earth. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Nanu.
But yeah, you want to talk about like where the giant foreheads come from, like this island Earth. And dude, if you want to watch the best version of this island Earth, go out and find yourself the Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie, because that is the best way to watch
all the boring parts from this island Earth. I love this island Earth. The mutant is one of my favorite.
Oh, it's like, one of the most famous
movie monsters.
Yeah, it's one of the movie monsters ever. Yeah, no, this island Earth is a phenomenal movie. It's just
But when you're telling people to watch the version that cuts out like an hour of the film,
I adore that version of that movie. But
it's my favorite Mystery Science Theater piece of ever anything. I'll go on Earth for that.
But Coneheads definitely right. This island Earth, and some other stuff. I don't want to cannibalize some.
Yeah,
of
that's
stuff
fine.
That
that's
we're going to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean that's the thing to know about it. Let's go to it, right? We're an hour into this episode. We've talked very little about Adam Sandler, so it seems like it's time for my favorite part of the show. I hope Sejan's favorite part of the show, and yours too, listener. Something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. In which we name something that would be new if this film were to become a member of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe we're creating, something old that already existed within the films that are part of the ASCU, something borrowed from outside of this universe, probably through some sort of crazy transmat sliders technology, and something blue, the definition of which is always highly contested between Sejan and I. So Sejan, why don't you go first with the new?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time and probably only time that we're going to be able to get an infallible Sandler, right? Like, this is, like there's no time for him to have a flaw and that sort of thing. But this character is not, it's not, like, just because he's a small side character and there's not much growth allowed for the character doesn't mean that, like, there's not a personality there, right? Like, we definitely understand a lot about Carmine in the moments he's on screen. And, like, weirdly, the character, the guy that I kept thinking of was the wolf played by Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction, where, like, he just, like, he shows up just in the third story. He's just a side character. He is completely infallible, though. He's basically omnipresent, right, for that portion of that movie.
Yeah.
And, like, he is their god in that moment and saves their life.
Not just
and
omnipresent, like, but omnipotent.
But
omnipotent?
The fact,
like, is that what
omnipotent?
Said?
Yeah. But like, he is this godlike figure that shows up and literally the Deus Ex Machina of that movie, right? So in this moment, for Carmine to show up and basically be able to deliver exactly what Beldar needs, right? And he is calm, cool, collected, straight to the point. Like, we're never going to get a Sandler that is this well done. I mean, unless he ends up in a fucking, like, Tarantino movie in 5 years, which he totally could. But, like, we have not yet gotten this character again from him, right? So the infallible Sandler is pretty new to us, and I don't know if we'll ever get the opportunity to really indulge in it again.
You know what the craziest part about the infallible Sandler is? And this is... And I don't mean if I'm cannibalizing what you have later on, I do apologize. We've seen Dan Aykroyd in other films that we have placed in the Sandler cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened. That scene, right? And why I think this film is super important and why it's definitely worth covering. I mean, anything that he's been in is kind of fair game for the show. That's just facts.
We've made that pretty clear, right.
So that's like, and this definitely fits as a remake, as a reboot of the sketches, a remake of the animated series, and a redo of a lot of the jokes. The Coneheads fit this theme very well. That's just a fact. But when you look at Dan Aykroyd in that scene,
yeah,
and he is fully, fully ceding control of that moment to this young fucking greenhorn actor, comedian, mm-hmm. It is impressive. It's mostly impressive because Adam Sandler doesn't shit himself in that moment. Sandler is so in control of that scene, even in terms of improv, because, like, we did the scene at the beginning, right? That's the scene that we recreated. We always do our scene at the beginning of the show. And that was when we did, probably because it's the one that Adam Sandler's in, but I found the original script and how it was scripted out and the amount of things that Adam Sandler like added into it that makes it just feel more real and really adds to that infallibility that you're speaking of.
He makes Carmine cool. Like he really does make Carmine he makes him into a player. Right. Like Carmine is the guy that can get the job done, even in the original script. But the way that Sandler plays him, Carmine is the guy that can get the job done, and Carmine fucking knows it. Yep. Like it's that last little bit of just like confidence and attitude that, again, we don't get to see too often in other characters that Sandler has played, or at least we don't get to see it pay off.
Right. He's a little bit confident in The Longest Yard, but he's also broken. So there's some interesting things within it all. But that scene, it is a lot. And that infallibility, and also I think that's one of the reasons why years down the road, and he's like, hey, Aykroyd, do you want to be the fire chief in Chuck and Larry? He says yes.
Well, Aykroyd has a lot of problems as a creative, as a human being. There's a lot to unpack when being a fan of the stuff Aykroyd has created and really not calling myself a Dan Aykroyd fan, right? Like, I just can't bring myself to really give two shits about the guy. But, like, the ways in which he is always willing to support whatever movie he's in, he does not always take over, right? Like, one of the big things is, God, I fucking love Farley. But when Farley comes onto the scene in this movie, it becomes Chris Farley scenes. Like, those are the reasons you're watching those scenes, are to see what crazy shit Chris Farley's going to get up to next, right? He takes over. And that's just the way that he always was. That's just the personality he was in all of his films. So, I mean, we've talked about Wayne's World. He has that phenomenal role as the security guard in Wayne's World, where, again, he just takes over that scene. Or in Billy Madison, a show that we've watched for this very movie, where he plays the bus driver. Like, he comes on and just takes over. And it's the complete opposite for somebody like Aykroyd. Aykroyd falls into the background. You know, he's a phenomenal support. And one of my favorite roles for him of all time is the main big bad in Gross Point Blank. And bing, bang, boom, popcorn. I love him in that movie. But, like, he's only in, like, 20 minutes of that movie. And, like, he's phenomenal when he is. But I don't think about that as a Dan Aykroyd film, right? Like, it's very distinctly, like, I think of Minnie Driver and the sexy-ass voice on the radio. And I think of, what's his nuts there?
John Cusack?
Say Anything. John Cusack, yeah.
I think Say Anything.
Well, the reason I was getting confused is because I was about to say Joan Cusack, who I also think
is also great.
Also phenomenal in that movie, yeah. Aykroyd's ability to show up anywhere and fade into the background, whether that's the fire chief in that, or you know, he has other roles in this universe. He also plays, speaking of Chris Farley, like showing up in Tommy Boy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's great as Callahan.
Callahan.
And it's like, Peter Seeger universe that we're talking about there that we
And then we get into 51st Dates where he
so it is it's an interesting
thing.
Yeah,
I forgot that he was in 51st Dates because again, like, I don't think about Aykroyd when he shows up in a movie. He just melts into whatever he's doing.
Right. But to see him melt into the background in a scene with Adam Sandler, like, he has
an unproven
Adam Sandler. It's incredible because that scene could be about Beldar's reaction to what Carmine is saying.
We should mention the third person Sinbad. Sinbad, who is also amazing in this movie and then disappears at some point. It's so disappointing that he disappears in the second act of this movie.
But it makes so much sense.
It makes sense. Like, it makes sense for the time jump and what this movie represents.
Everything makes sense in it. It is such a well-supported, well-crafted world that they built for a movie that is so much fried chicken embryos. I don't know. And I will say this for the film, and before we move on to my new, a lot of the, like, retread of jokes happen at the very beginning of the film. Like,
right, they want to remind you why
you're there. An entire pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
Which that has to be, Dan Aykroyd has to be so happy that he finally got to have all of the cigarettes appear lit at once, because he tries it so many times in the sketches and it never really works. And it's something. But yeah, I like that. I like the infallible Sandler. And then I took the easy way out, right? I did a lot of work for this group project. I'm just going to say Saturday Night Live. And by the fact that this is Adam Sandler's first and only collaboration and appearance in a Saturday Night Live film, this is the only time that we got to see it. And it is very... So, like, Saturday Night Live, again, in high school, it was something that we watched, right? We'd all be hanging out on Saturday night, and we'd throw it on. Or we'd be hanging out in the thing, and it would just be the background noise on Comedy Central. I've never been the largest fan of Saturday Night Live, and, like, weirdly, that extends to the movies, right? I mean, I like enough of Wayne's World. I appreciate it as a film, but as something influenced by SNL, I didn't really get there. This movie, Coneheads, as an influence from the stuff that had happened in SNL and, like, building on it and making it its own, they did such a good job with that.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, there are two moments in this film, and they're directly related to the Saturday Night Live of it all, so I'm gonna pop them in here. One is the Senso-Ring scene where Pre-Matt is done up sort of like Marie Antoinette with the big blonde wig, and she throws the Senso-Ring. And it lands on Beldar's head.
Oh, my God. And the big, like, the moment where he takes the drink out of the big, goblet.
But specifically the censoring, her throwing it and it landing on his head was the most satisfying thing for me. Because almost every...
I think for him, too.
Well, yeah, right? But almost every Conehead sketch ends with them playing ring toss. And then it eventually, as Dan Aykroyd completed his volumes on Conehead's physiology, biology, and anatomy, right? The 5,000-page series available through Time Warner for 17 easy payments of $9.95 plus shipping and handling. As he, like, developed it, that ring toss was how they pleasured each other.
Yeah.
And every time, Dan Aykroyd freaking nails it. He throws that ring and he gets it on Jane Curtin's head. And Jane Curtin misses. She misses every time. And she breaks character every fucking time she misses. And, like, because the first time she misses and it's just like, oh, you know, we're just, like, having fun in this moment. It's just a ring toss. But as it becomes a deeper friggin' part of the lore and everything that's going on, her continuing to miss, it becomes such a big thing that when they finally use Senso rings in the animated pilot for the series that never went going, Pre-Matt still misses Beldar's head. So it was the first time that I saw Pre-Matt throw a Senso ring and it land on Beldar's head. So of course he was satisfied. It's the first time that his wife has satisfied him since 1977, Seijin.
Oh
Sorry,
man.
sorry.
Yeah, so the movie, like, it well, no, it's we should take this moment to talk about like where the comedy from this movie truly comes from. And it really is like that 1950s Dick Van Dyke Life with
Father
Lucy
knows best. It is Father
style
knows
of
best.
but style of sitcom comedy that is based in these tropes, you know, and we've talked a thousand times on the show Proper Say Report about the problems with that, but like to rehash it a little bit here, right? Like the idea that those come from a really kind of gross place, right? And
Yes.
so like this movie is in this really interesting place for me because he's clearly parodying that sort of stuff, satirizing. Oh my God, talking like a conehead after all this time. But he's satirizing like
Maintain low tone, Sejan.
That story of American immigration, of like they are becoming true blue American couple in this movie. They have a kid, they get a house, he works these small jobs until he's finally in a job where he can kind of support everybody, right? And you know, there's even this bit where this woman seduces him and he very openly, you know, denies her because he loves his wife at home, and then they have this beautiful moment together. Like there's a lot of just very straightforward, easy storytelling in this, that like the point of it is supposed to be that they are just experiencing this American life, right? And like it's a wild way to like to string together these bits and these jokes into this movie, because it does become a very satisfying experience in the end, because there's no real true conflict in this movie. Like even when they go off to another planet, like that was their end goal anyway, so I never felt that they were in any real danger. And then there's finally a moment where he is in danger, but by that point, things have gotten so silly that we're straight up in like a fucking Harryhausen scene with like a claymation figure running around, right?
God, the Garflock is so good. The design and all the influence in there, just it's. I mean, I do. I really enjoy the film. Two other SNL things, and then we'll look at the old and what it brings back. The fact that the Farbers are their neighbors, the third Conehead sketch features the Farbers, played by John Belushi, and I don't remember who plays his wife, but it's nice there. But then the movie was sold for me as like a good Coneheads movie when Garrett Morrison was the pilot of the Star Cruiser taking them home. Because Garrett Morrison was the fourth Conehead. He would act as an emissary from Remulac who would come and bring messages before eventually John Belushi was introduced as the High Master of the planet. So it was like to see Garrett Morrison get to be, especially because like Phil Hartman, and why wouldn't you put Phil Hartman in this SNL movie in 1993, right?
Yeah.
RIP Phil. It like he takes the role that Garrett Morrison essentially did throughout all of the sketches. And the animated series whitewashes that character. So I was nervous that he wasn't going to show up. And then he shows up piloting the starship, and I'm like, that's all I needed. That was the last thing that I needed to be like, they did a good job being beholden to the source material, but also making it its own thing. I mean, because the INS thing is such a brilliant thing for 1990s like
Yeah,
conflict.
so like it tells this whole story about like this immigration stuff with the INS after them, and Michael McKean, phenomenally in this role, plays this awesome American agent like villain character who like gives up halfway through the movie. It's a wild move. He gets a promotion and he basically is just like, ah, fuck it, it's the next guy's problem, and then doesn't worry about them for over a decade and a half.
Until he's forced to again.
Until he's forced to reconfront it because this senator from fucking nowhere, played marvelously by Kevin Nealon, like pulls out this old record to basically stomp on his nuts in a fucking business meeting, which is like the most bullshit reason to pull this thing out. Yeah, it was, man. But Michael McKean as this just like overzealous immigration agent was just so much fucking fun, and he's perfect in this role as like this skeezy figure.
This conservative government employee in employee in the Clinton years. Like, yeah, that's what I love. You see his well, he's deputy commissioner. You see his office with the framed Reagan and Bush Sr. photos.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm just like, what great mise-en-scene for this character. Like, why does he want to be he wants to be the commissioner to, like, kind of chop off Clinton's balls with what he's doing to the country. There's right. so much going on in the background if you consider the politics at the time. It's some cool stuff. And I can't believe it took us an hour and 17 minutes to mention that Michael McKean was in this movie. Also, Eddie Griffin's in this movie. We're big fans of Eddie Griffin. I'm a big fan of Eddie Griffin.
Well, so, I mean, the way that this movie, but the way that this movie does this, like awesome move of pulling in everybody, but also you can see, like, where Sandler kind of learns this bit, where, like, you know, even if they're only on screen for a couple of lines, it's still fun to work with this guy for a day, right? I mean, like, my favorite pull for this entire thing has to be Dave Thomas as the High Master at the end of this movie. Like, getting Dave Thomas in this movie and getting him to play this role was just fucking choice, because he's such a good just cartoonish villain for them at the end.
Yeah, I always think of this is the thing. I mean, John Lovitz is also in this because he's the dentist.
Yeah,
Dr. Rudolph. I always think of him as the High Master because of Mom and Dad Save the World.
Nice.
And yeah. So I always, like, confused those two because I had never really seen this movie, but they're very similar characters, those two. Yeah. Especially when you consider they're that
very similar movies.
Belushi's High Master character in the SNL sketches, he wants to mate with Connie. Like, that's his whole thing. He's like, I have decided your daughter will be my mate. And so for that, that's like the central focus of Mom and Dad Save the World. It's nuts. All right, so let's go to old. And I'll take the first one here. It's Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Which I love that they sneak in the costume ball just to reference the Coneheads on Halloween sketch. They don't get to the level of them giving out beer and fried eggs to trick-or-treaters and that upsetting parents. But it is, like, they have a costume ball and it's clearly not Halloween.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, one of the funniest things is to see the Coneheads in costumes. And Belder is Abraham Lincoln, and how big a fucking factor Abraham Lincoln has been throughout all of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe is very choice. And then I also just, like, big kudos to Pre-Matt's lipstick costume.
Nice.
That is just it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with Abraham Lincoln as my old.
Excellent. I didn't know, like, okay, so I know that I talked about the idea of, like, confident, successful, like Sandler, right, in this moment. But I also could not shake the feeling that we were just looking at an early Howard Ratner. Like, it felt
what
like
a fucking statement. I love it.
It felt like that we were watching basically Howard, like, in his younger years, and this was him just, like, wheeling and dealing when he was younger, and he eventually finds himself running that fucking, like, jewelry store, and then he gets himself shot.
Well, and you understand, and the really great thing about that is, I was gonna call him the Chico, Carmine is very good at selling the lie. Mm-hmm. He should not be giving every one of his customers the same fucking social security number.
With the same information, like the same name and everything.
They have,
like,
different dates of birth. And that's the one thing that I dig about the whole thing. Because there is that scene where David Spade, because David Spade's in this movie, I don't know if we've mentioned that, prints out the list of all the Donald DeChicos. And yeah, they all have different dates of birth. And the one in Jersey City is an accountant, but he's born in November. So Carmine sold the Donald R. DeChico identity to two people in Jersey City, but both of them with the 1951 birth date. But one in August and one in November. It's just these little attention to detail moments that, of course, you would expect in a Dan Aykroyd script. And they really do a lot of heavy lifting for stuff that is not told to you explicitly by the film. So, like, Carmine eventually becoming Howard Ratner, of course, because in the moment, he's the smoothest motherfucker, and you want to give him everything and your firstborn.
But he's also an idiot.
Yeah. But he is leveraging himself to the fucking limits, and at any given moment, he's going to get shot in the fucking head.
Well, and I thought it was really interesting in this movie that with all of the shit that they put on him, and this is really just speaks to McKean's character, right, as the baddie, but it's always for him about catching the people using that. He never once says we should find out how they've all got the same number, right? It's this bit where he goes down the list of all the Tachikos they've caught, and then, like, no mention of we should get the guy that's actually, like, doing this.
There was a Samoan, a Vietnamese, a Sicilian, a Canadian, and a Belgian.
And the Belgian
got back
away.
To Belgium.
Yeah, the Belgian
I'm catching
got away.
This one. And also the fact that, like, where he's presented with evidence that they are clearly extraterrestrials. They are aliens, not of this planet. And David Spade's like, is that really our jurisdiction? And his resolve in the comment, once they start to try to live here and make a living here, that's our jurisdiction.
If they're just visiting, I suppose that would be, what does he say?
Air Force.
Air Force.
Yeah.
He's like, if they're just visiting, that's Air Force. But the second they want a job, that's our jurisdiction.
He's so into it. Ah. And I could totally see that type of character influencing shit like American Dad later on down the line. Like, it's
for sure. Yeah.
It's solid work. But I dig that early Howard Radner in the character of Carmine.
I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I tried to focus specifically on the Sandler scene, you know, because But and so like I watched it again and I was just like, man, like, this feels so much like the ways that Howard talks, but without the tension around it of you knowing that Howard's gonna fail, right? Yeah. And like, yeah, it's
And even when Carmine fails in this film, he doesn't really.
Not for Carmine. No, it just doesn't work out for Belda, right?
Yeah. Or the five other Donnie Artichicos from Massachusetts.
Four out of the five.
True. Good times. Good times. All right, time for Borrowed. I'm looking forward to what you got to say here.
I mean, okay, so this movie clearly is influenced by a lot of sci-fi stuff. We've talked about all the various ones so far, but, like, Star Trek is the number one pull. There is so much Star Trek in the world building of this, specifically original trilogy. And it's even to the point where one of the first scenes we see is, I think, Michael Richards or somebody. No. Not Michael Richards.
Jonathan Penner, of all actors. We'll see him in Down Periscope a couple of years later. At the Air Force Base.
But at the Air Force Base. Watching an episode of Star Trek.
They're watching the pilot. The original pilot of Star Trek.
But that is the ways in which we're kind of introduced to the idea of aliens in this movie. Like, Aykroyd wants us to be thinking of Star Trek. To then we get to the final act of this movie where he goes up against a fucking, like, stop motion beast in basically, like, you know, hand to hand death combat, right? Like, you might as well have just had Spock there alongside him, being like, one of us has to die so the other may live. Like it was so heavily influenced by the Star Trek stuff, and Klingons and Romulans specifically were the two big races I was thinking of, although I think at this point I don't know how much the Romulans show up in the original trilogy. They're more kind of next generation, but like, still, that, like, the prosthetic work, the comedy, the weird, like, we're gonna just have a weird physiology, like, he has no butt, like, when they show him naked and things like that.
And he's,
like,
got butt nipples.
Yeah. There's just all sorts of just, like, weird little bits like that that then they very much want to show you. You know, there's also some, like, Doctor Who stuff going on, like, a lot of that sort of stuff. But Star Trek is so obviously an influence on Aykroyd in making this movie.
Deal. I can completely do it. They literally borrow It's a Wonderful Life for one scene, and then suddenly the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life turns into bowling, which is just excellent. But my borrowed, and as heavily influenced by Star Trek as this is, I mean, they lift shots and sequences and score from The Day the Earth Stood Still with the opening. Like, it is this really cool stuff. We already touched on the Tim Burton of it, but there is so much on this Newman score that is Tim Burton inspired.
Yep.
Like, there's, like, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da from Beetlejuice. Bam, 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 bam. It's like, oh, okay, I didn't realize I was watching Beetlejuice right now. So there's a lot borrowed from other things that are going on in cinema. The big one would be The Day the Earth Stood Still, because it's there. But also, like, the first 10 minutes of this movie is that they have to phone home.
Yeah.
And to the fact that right before he phones home, she says, phone home. Like, it is, yeah, we get it. E.T. was a thing, Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
I promise Steven Spielberg is watching. He loves.
But, I mean, you know, you mentioned the whole thing about fuck, we were just talking about it with Nanu.
Day of the Earth. Oh, This Island Earth or Day
This
of the
Island Earth.
Earth. Yeah.
Well, so for anybody that has not seen that movie, the big like first act of that film is that an Earth scientist is tasked with creating a communication device in order to speak to what he thinks is like a really genius Earthling, but then finds out it's an alien race trying to contact him, right? And that device, the Lassiter or something like that, the Tenaciter, I forget what they call it in that movie, but it was so reminiscent of the device that the Conan's build in this one to talk to their people, where he has to like put his face in like the toilet seat in like the mask. Yeah. But all I could think of was that device from this island Earth that they have to build in order to communicate with the aliens on the other planet.
Yeah, it's a lot of 50s sci-fi that's just on display, and it's wonderful. And obviously, I mean, that's what Dan Aykroyd loved. Dan Aykroyd's talking esoteric about things that he made up, things that are not real, except for in his mind, and for like honoring the sci-fi that influenced that love in him.
Yeah.
And it's all over this film. And it's kind of wonderful, if you really think about it for a second.
Interocitor. It was going to kill me if I did not look that up.
I'm glad you looked it up, because I could not remember.
He builds a complex device called an interocitor. Neither Meacham nor his assistant, Joe Wilson, have heard of such a device, but they immediately begin its construction and somehow figure out how to build it, reading an alien language in a book that they're told how to build it. It's such a weird movie. I love that movie.
It's a good time. Also, I'm going to go back to old and just say Subway, right? This is where Adam Sandler realized Subway's got deep pockets.
Yeah, Subway's not afraid to put to shame themselves.
Seeing those super cool one cups, that was a blast from the past.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to blue. I will go first because it's a weird freaking moment, and it speaks to the PG rating. So Beldar has to narfle the Garflock at the end of the movie. He sings Tainted Love, run away.
Why, by the way?
Because he's doing it for his daughter. It is all motif to recognize. He looks at Connie and he realized that I want to live, I want to survive, and I want to do it for her. So he sings the song that this film, much like Bohemian Rhapsody and Wayne's World before it, suddenly becomes relevant again because of this movie. Tainted Love is the real winner of Coneheads. That and Joey Lauren Adams and Parker Posey.
I don't understand why he feels the need to sing it out in the field when it being quiet would have been the better option. Such a weird moment. He's like hiding from this creature, and then he just starts screaming out the lyrics to Tainted Love out of tune.
I know, it's for his daughter. It's specifically to let her know that I'm going to survive this. It's like secret communications between a parent and his child.
All right, it's like Carol Burnett pulling on her ear for her mom at the end of each episode. It's a weird choice.
Taking my notes today as I watched the scene, I broke out in tears because I realized all of the emotional weight that is meant to exist behind that moment. And I don't know if I was crying because of the emotional weight. Yeah. Or because, like, guys, that's what you thought was going to be there, and it does not happen. And I'm so sad for you.
In that particular vein, they are much more successful later with the cheesy-ass but perfectly landed line. What father would not want to give his daughter the earth, or whatever he says? Like I gave you the earth for your birthday, or that bit. Right?
I gave you the world.
Right, like that moment lands really well. So if that's what they're trying to, hit that same feeling in this, it did not work for me. Sorry, but you were going to talk about something.
I mean, it's singing the song as he realizes he wants to fight for his daughter. Heavy emotional tears. Like, that's what I wrote, because because it is. It's weird. It's weird that he's singing Tainted Love.
What does this have to do with blue?
Oh, what are we talking about, blue? Oh, yeah. So he fights. He narfles the Garflock. He uses Chekhov's golf balls to kill the Garflock. And then it cuts to a wide shot of him, and he is covered in blue blood.
Which wasn't there before. It doesn't make any sense.
There's no blood. He essentially chokes the monster to death, and that's the end of it.
Did you see the Garflock is cut in half?
The Garflock is beheaded.
And like the head is like on the altar, like next to the High Master. Like you can see the neck stump behind Dave Thomas's feet. Yeah, it's real weird.
So there's a cut scene where he does behead the Garflock and throw the head up there. And that's why he's covered in that blood. And in a film where there's so much blue, I could have gone with the Cosmopolitan cover. I could have gone with the fact that they're Connie school colors. I could have gone with the fact that the whole motif of the marketing is the color blue. Farley's powder blue tux. I had to go with that blue blood because it's such a weird moment. It's from nowhere. And yeah. It's weirdly like makes it the most graphic scene in the movie.
Yeah,
but they don't show the more graphic thing because they're so beholden to trying to get that PG rating.
What a fucking ballsy ass 1993 move to cut the entire scene that explains it and not reshoot it with him without blood on him. They just let that scene just turn into him being there with a golf club in hand, having kicked the shit out of that thing from a distance, to then suddenly a shot of him covered in blue blood. And you're just like, what the fuck? What's that? And then credits roll like less than 10 minutes later, so you don't even have time.
Well, after he's faked his own death. And weirdly, we do see the guy who's like, I think I can beat the Garflock, and we see him beheaded, and like, I think the insides of Coneheads are blue. You mentioned the Jan Hooks like cheating storyline, and I'm really happy that that didn't go the same way as it does in the sketches, where there's a sketch where Beldar is cheating on Premat with a human woman, and we see his chest open and exposed, and he has like really gross blue veins that like make up what would be the chest hair of a human. Is like real great. And then the way that ends, right, because I was like heartbroken to think that they were cheating on each other, is the reveal that Premat is also sleeping with a human. So like, it's okay, they cheated on each other, right? And they came back to each other.
They have an open marriage. That's fine.
They have an open marriage. Well, I mean, of course, if you're stuck for 7 Zerls on an alien planet, are you not gonna fuck the local fauna?
I mean, especially when part of the reason that you're there is to explore and discover what the world's all about, right? Like, you know,
it's very Star Trek, as you said, right? Because Captain Kirk was on a 5-year mission to fuck everything in the galaxy with compatible genitalia.
And Spock just kept trying to tell him that maybe this was not necessary, but Shatner specifically was like, of course it is.
I'm a doctor, Jim, not an STD scientist.
That would be Bones, but we're not going to have this conversation.
No, Bones is who I was talking about. I was doing Bones as well. Because in addition to Spock being like, you really don't need to fuck everything, Kirk. You have Bones, like, we're running out of penicillin from all of these fucking various alien diseases you're contracting. You're putting the entire crew in jeopardy. God damn it, Jim.
I'm a doctor, not a pimp, damn it.
I'm a doctor, not Jerry Orwell in Dirty Dancing. Oh. What's your blue, Seijin?
So this is, I gotta say that with a PG rating, this movie does not, like get outwardly upsetting too often, but there's definitely some stuff that goes on in this movie. I was wondering if I should focus on a little bit of some of the stuff that happens specifically with Ronnie and, like, the dating, abuse feels like a strong word, but, like things have labels for a reason. Like, there's the entire plot line with Chris Farley's character in this movie is that, like, he pushes her too far and she's not comfortable with it. And like, we watch him apologize for exactly that. Like, he doesn't hide it. And, like, he gets punished for what he did, but also is able to, like, work with her to move past it, which I thought was really interesting, but also kind of weird and, like, a weird message. And so, like, I couldn't quite settle on anything there. And then I went back and rewatched it today and realized that I was missing really a huge part of the first act of this movie. And that's just turbans, like the use of turban to introduce the idea of otherness, and like the ways in which this movie really leans into, because they are quote unquote aliens, right? Like the, like that joke is used a lot. And so the ways that this movie really wants to be that, like, good guy on your side, like that fun dad in the group, right? Like everybody nowadays, like, you know, that dad in the group that's hip with the kids and understands, like, oh, they use different pronouns, so I'm gonna make sure that I use those pronouns correctly. Not every dad in the group is that cool, right? The problem is that this dad is trying just a little too hard, right? He's trying so hard to be, like, on your side that it starts to feel a little disingenuous in moments. And I think that's as blue as this movie ever gets, is like with some of the racism that this movie kind of displays. I don't think it's coming from a malicious place of, like, let's laugh at these people because they're different, but rather, like, the fact that these people have to, like, the fact that we cannot wrap our heads around these people being in our country is the joke, but it just doesn't land every time, right? And then, like, the same goes for some of the stuff that happens with the dating stuff is like, yeah, like the fact that this is that this is the kind of stuff that would be dealt with in these old sitcom-y stories of like, oh, he put his hands on me when I told him no, and so now I'm mad at him, but in less than 30 minutes, like, we're gonna be back together, so don't you worry. Like, that same attitude comes across of just like, you're kind of downplaying a lot of these issues just for the sake of comedy. And I think that's the most blue this movie gets for me.
That's, I gotta say, that whole Ronnie Connie thing, I kind of thought that that's where you were gonna go. So you really, that was a real emotion you just took me on, man. You were a roller coaster boy just now, Sejin. I'm sorry. inside jokes get you inside work. But yeah, so it really was, that was a roller coaster. I thought about that, but then as I was watching it, I'm like, they really kind of do a good job about how society is pressuring them in this way that, like, that's what you do.
It's not even like they do a good job. It's the fact that they make any effort, period, to really kind of explore the beat,
like, yeah,
rather than just, like, have it just be the trope and then they use it to just springboard into more tropes. Like, the fact that they actually do go back to it and, like, Ronnie tries to apologize to her and to him, right? Like, trying to find Beldar on the course and stuff like that. And then we see the moment where they forgive each other, which is weird because she shouldn't have to forgive her for him for anything, but anyway, but like there's a lot more here than there needs to be. It's still not enough, though, I think, is what my point is.
Yeah.
Right, it's like it still doesn't go as far as it needs to, but for 1993, I was surprised by how much was there.
I was too, I will admit that. But like her being like, I mean, I like him, I have feelings for him, should I have gone there? I'm like, this is real, like, after school special stuff. I hope that they just don't let this go, because I knew that there was the scene with him taking her to prom.
Right, and, right, like, right, right.
They do. I think the thing, and also the otherness, to talk on the otherness, I like how all of these people of otherness are so accepting of them and also willing to put themselves on the line for them. Like,
well, I think it's the big bit with all three of them, but specifically with Beldar, because let's be honest, this movie, as much as it is of a Coneheads movie, Beldar is really the highlight Conehead of this movie, right? And
yeah.
And it, I mean, specifically in the ways in which the heft of the plot is really laden on him to carry. And I think that when one of the big interesting bits of the movie, like the joke of this movie, I don't know, you can speak to the sketches, but he is loved, like he is beloved, like it's they are so well accepted everywhere that they go, like immediately, like the only person that really calls out anything weird about them at any moment is the second that Tom Arnold is on screen and has like a weird bit about like, hey buddy, what's with the head? Like nobody else ever seems to have that moment with them. Even Michael Keane's character, when he first like introduces himself, I think the first time he meets them is when he's pretending to be the Jehovah's Witness, like even he is able to like hold his shit together and just like talk to them. And then even when it's revealed later who he really is, like he never has this moment of like disrespecting them, despite the fact that he is with his actions, he's not with his words, which is really interesting.
And I mean, that's part of the bit. There are three legs to the stool of a Coneheads sketch, and the first one is the fact that they are, you know, not familiar with the customs of our planet.
Right.
The second is the voice. You get to do the voice. But then the third, and honestly, the most important, like, leg of the stool, is that the people they're interacting with do not act as if anything strange is going on.
No, everybody seems to be genuinely trying to make sure that, like, they're, like, trying to get them. Right.
Yeah.
Like every time they have a conversation, people are always like checking in to make sure they're on the same page, that type of stuff. And it's cool. It's nobody's.
It's a very cool part of it. And I mean, like the one with Frank Zappa, who goes on to write a song called Conehead, where like he's going to date as Frank Zappa. He's picking up Connie to take her to a concert. It's so crazy. But like, it's so like, Frank Zappa is so just like, yeah, man, you're pretty cool and stuff like that. Like, it's just so great. And even like Eli Turnbull from the sketches, right? Because David Spade's character is based on an IRS agent that was played by Steve Martin in the second sketch. Even he's like, why did you have to write off all these, like all this beer? and it's like, it is fuel for us. And it's, they do like really good stuff where the people are just like, even though they look different, even though they sound different, I'm still going to treat them like another member of my species.
Right. And like, cool. And that's where the humor comes from, right? Yeah. Like that's the joke. And so like, I do appreciate that. It's just that it does also then kind of put Aykroyd in this position to like tell some problematic humor here or there. But it's also, I think by the very nature that it feels neutered, that almost makes it worse. Right.
because you're aware of it, you're hyper keyed into it. And then like, specifically, a couple of years later, we're going to see something like the Brady Bunch, where they are 70s ideals, but in the 90s. So, like, that idea of what we're talking about specifically with this movie, because it also feels like they're 50s ideals that were on display in the 70s, then being put on display in the 90s.
Right.
Yeah. So it just feels like, so, like, what is going on? Why would they act this way? Why have they not assimilated better? And it's a, this is an interesting film, but I will say overall, I enjoyed it. I did like it. I've enjoyed my time with the entire Coneheads oeuvre and universe. And I'm excited to read those comics. I just didn't want them to color my ability to talk about the movie, but I think it's time, Sijin. I mean, we've already gone longer than the film itself with its hour and 26 minute runtime. So it's time for us to determine, is this part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe?
Well, this will be a surprise to no one, but I played my hand as early as I could in this episode. But no, like, this is not in any way part of that. I think it's extremely influential in the ways in which this movie is produced and marketed and out there by the time Sandler is the one making movies. You don't have Billy Madison being shaped the way in which Billy Madison was shaped without Coneheads or Wayne's World or Blues Brothers or any of these before it, right? Or Pat or, you know.
Stuart Saves His Family.
Right.
I agree. I mean, there's no way it is. Maybe it's a glimpse at the potential, a parallel universe where Sandler sticks with Saturday Night Live and doesn't branch out to do his own stuff because there's no way. There's just no way that this world that uses him for one scene uses him like to the fullest extent of Adam Sandler usage in that scene as Carmine. But like, would he have ever risen above that if he had stayed under the thumb of Lorne Michaels? Probably not. Because Lorne Michaels didn't really like him. Based on everything that we've heard.
So yeah, like, but Michaels ends up producing like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, doesn't he? Aren't those like Lorne Michaels produced even though they're not SNL movies? Or am I misremembering that? I might be misremembering that.
I don't think so. I think that they're made like in spite of Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
Because it really is like that's the beginning of the end of Sandler being part of SNL is when he's not going to do those. And then they're also successful. I mean, you look at Coneheads, one of the craziest things to talk about, and then we can wrap this up because we've delivered the goods on this reboot, remake, redo that is Coneheads. This film had a huge market presence in the UK and was never released theatrically there because of how badly it performed in America.
Interesting.
Like that's just an insane thing to me. It was straight to VHS over there. And I don't know if it ever released in France because historically they're like, we want you to get rid of all the France jokes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're like, well, we're not gonna do that.
Yeah, we're not gonna do that. Man, I'm looking over some of Sandler's biggest characters on SNL, and like you couldn't really do a character movie with him. Or if you could, he kind of did that thing that we talked about where he altered it and just did his own. Like Cajun Man, right? And Canteen Boy both kind of become your Bobby Boucher, right? Mm-hmm. But even Lucy Braun, the Gap Girls that he would do with Farley and Spade, like you see that in Jack and Jill, right?
Yep.
And then, like, you look at Hank Gelfand, and that's the guy that would do the ratings where Farley would play his wife. Mm-hmm. And, like, you can't do that bit without Farley, right? No, like, yeah. And then beyond that, you have Brian, and, which is the guy that is waiting by the phone, the guy that always tells you about, like, his ex-girlfriend, right? Yeah. which is basically every character he already plays in every movie. The Pepper Boy.
Which, Opera Man.
And so the only one that it was the number one on the list is of characters that he did most frequently is Opera Man, and I already made that joke this episode.
Yeah, so I don't know. And I will say this, because you said that he never took anything from the blah, like comedy albums or anything like that. Whitey is the only one that transcends and winds
That's
up
true.
In a film.
Whitey is a pretty direct one-to-one. Yeah.
But even then, he doesn't play him the first time. It's Dana Carvey doing Whitey and Little Nicky.
Yeah.
So it's an even weirder sort of experience. This has been interesting so far, the reboots, remakes, and redos, because I don't think any of them have landed in
Holy
the...
Holy shit. The Do you remember Gil Graham, the rock and roll correspondent for Weekend Update?
No.
It's just Little Nicky. It's him with blonde hair instead of black hair, but same Little Nicky bit. Yeah, I never really realized how much he kind of just took his characters from SNL and was basically like, fuck you, I'll just make them my own.
copy my work, but change it enough so that the teacher doesn't realize you copied my work.
Yeah.
And that, honestly, I think watching something like, well, he watches Mike Myers do Wayne, right? Yeah. And then gets stuck in Wayne, right? Like, he's like, you have to do the second movie.
Yeah.
So, like, that's what happens. And then Mike Myers, in order to escape that, has to go off and do his own thing.
Right? Yeah, I think the only other movie in that time period is probably, like, So I Married an Axe Murderer, right. Which is not a
and
huge
that's
success
not
at the
a
time.
Huge success, but it is his breakaway from Saturday Night Live. It's Michael Myers saying, I want to do my own thing.
Right.
And then, you know, after well, and then
Carvey,
and everything like
Carvey's
that.
In the same boat, getting stuck playing Garth in both of those movies, and then he goes on to do something like Clean Slate, right? Isn't that the one that he does in the 90s?
So, yeah. I think that's the name of it. I don't know. But then he also does the Dana Carvey show, too.
Well,
where,
yeah.
Like, I'm not only am I going to break ties with SNL because all they want me to be is Garth Algar, but I'm going to break ties with SNL and do my own sketch show.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to be the SNL of ABC.
Right.
So it's this weird thing where almost all these people who end up doing the Saturday Night Live movies end up realizing that if we stay in this environment, and I don't know, I mean, it's the sort of the chicken and the egg in the really, or I guess the chicken and the embryo, where you, sorry, do they decide that they don't want to stay under SNL because they see Adam Sandler have the success when he moves away from them?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, it's, I don't know, but I certainly think that watching this and seeing how beholden to the characters that Adam Sandler watches on Coneheads and just watches Mike Myers go through with Wayne's World is the type of thing where, like, I don't want to get stuck doing these characters forever.
Right.
So I'm going to make them my own in different things.
Yeah.
And that's, I think it's why also we see so many different characters from Adam Sandler's films. It's an interesting time. And this
it was an interesting movie to go back to, especially because this is one that I do, like, very frequently kind of find in, like, the background, like, playing around in my life. Like, the amount of times I've watched Dan Aykroyd eat a roll of toilet paper, like, it's ridiculous. I don't know why. Well,
it's
I guess
in the
because
trailer.
It's a PG. Well, and it's a PG comedy movie, which is a rare kind of get, right? So those end up being the ones that get shown at, like, bars and stuff a lot because, like, they're just easy. You know, you're not going to offend anybody by putting them on, but at the same time, it's something to watch.
Yeah, and if you're putting it on, you're probably putting it on right at the beginning, and that's, like, the fourth joke.
Yeah.
If you're going to be, like, gross about it. All right. Okay, so that's the Coneheads episode. Sorry that it's not in the universe if there was anyone out there who was hoping for it. I hope somebody made money in Las Vegas on the odds on this one not being in the ASCU, and I hope that nobody is destitute as a result of it. So we come to that part of the show where we tell people the next film in the season theme that we're going to be doing. And it's a bit of a break from tradition, but it kind of makes sense if you think about it. Do you know the next film that we're doing, Seijin?
Let's see. If we're trying to get less and less and less Sandler going on, I think at this point we're probably looking at something like Deuce Bigalow or something.
No, we're actually going to stay in the headspace that we're in right now. And do Airheads. Airheads is going to be the next remake, reboot, redo. Now, I know what you're saying to yourself, but that's not a rebate. remake or a reboot. How does that work? So in the very first year, first season of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, for the Say Report as a sort of crossover, we were able to break through the bonds of space and time and reach into another universe where instead of starting the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, alternate versions of Sijin and Devin created the Brendan Fraser Cinematic Universe. Now, I don't know how many times you've listened to that episode, but it's pretty much how I fall asleep every night. And I think now, in the fifth season, on the heels of Brendan Fraser winning his Best Actor Oscar, now's the time for us to redo that episode, but focusing on Adam Sandler's role in the film Airheads.
Yeah. Now that Brendan Fraser's won an Oscar, we're going to watch that movie and not talk about Brendan Fraser. I got to say, though, I didn't understand that episode that we found that time until finally when Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness came out, and that explained a lot for me. Yeah. So
it was a dream, Sijin. It was a dream.
Well, it was one of the branches on the tree, and then Wanda cuts it. It's fine. It's all a metaphor. It's fine.
But yes, so we're redoing an episode that alternate universe versions of ourselves already recorded about a different actor. So that's something to look forward to. But get used to that. But we also have other reboots, remakes, and redos for June. So it's not going to be a complete and total waste the end of this season. But I mean, it certainly feels that way after Coneheads, and I'm sorry. And I thank you, Sijin, for doing this. I thank you, the listener, for doing it. If you have anything that you want to say to us, we are on Twitter at the ASCU. That's also a really good place. If you have something specifically for Sijin, since Sijin is no longer on Twitter proper as himself, he only exists in the guise of our corporate accounts.
Yep, no, I cut that shit like Sandler walking off SNL, apparently. If you want to get out to Dev, though, he does still have a personal Twitter, and you can find him at Devin D. Decker.
And I would love to hear your theories about Coneheads. If you've gone down the same path as I, we may be kindred spirits and have a lot to discuss. I have a lot of thoughts about that animated pilot.
Yeah, man. It was a find.
It was a find, and it was enjoyable in some ways, and then in other ways, oh my, why did you think this was going to work as a kid's show? But, you know, that's that. So we will see you next month for Airheads. Thank you for joining us this month for Coneheads. And remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Enjoy the rest of your day, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.